This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is Richard Curran, the Smithsonian Institution's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture, speaking with us today about the history of America in 101 objects. Your book, Richard, is an exhibition of each of those iconic objects. Among them, a fragment of Plymouth Rock, Benjamin Franklin's walking stick, Samuel Colt's revolver, the Ford Model T, a baseball signed by Babe Ruth, and Apple's first Macintosh computer. The Smithsonian has the largest collection of museum objects in the world, 137 million of them, together with 19 million photographs. How did you manage to reduce so vast an embarrassment of riches to the number of 101? According to what rule or principle of selection?
Well, Lewis, that's not easy, as you can imagine, getting from 137 million to 101 and making a manageable book. Look, our curators at the Smithsonian, and we have hundreds of them who are scholars of history who know these objects well, all advocated for their items. You can only imagine the people at the National Stamp Museum saying 101 objects, everyone should be a stamp. Same thing with portraits. What I did is I tried to get a spread of American history. So we would get different periods, different eras of our history represented, and also deal with the representation of things like politics, the economy, invention, popular culture, artistry, and so on. You know, that's what a curator does when you're doing the same thing. As you said, if the book is an exhibition, I did the same thing a curator of the exhibition would do, which is pick things that are representative and tell interesting stories.
Well, they all do. I mean, there's Martha, the last passenger pigeon. There's Abraham Lincoln's hat. There is Sitting Bull's drawing book. Do you have any favorites among – this is really, truly a wonderful collection.
Well, you know, I do have favorites, and because I learned in doing this. You know, I am not – I'm an anthropologist, cultural anthropologist. I oversee our history museums and so on, know a good bit about American history, but nobody really has that expertise. So for me, coming to these objects was coming with a sense of discovery. I learned a ton about them. You know, in doing that, I learned not only about their place in history at that time, but I learned how they came to the Smithsonian and kind of the second life as a museum object. So in that way, they became especially interesting. They were also interesting to me because, you know, I don't know, when I was growing up and learning history, as I think many people do, you know, you learn about places and people and dates. It's pretty abstract. And I think objects have a way of bringing you to that time in history. They were part of it, so you could feel it. So, you know, one of those objects, when I look at, you mentioned Benjamin Franklin's staff. This was, you know, an item given to the United States by the family of George Washington. They gave two things to the United States in the 1840s. One was the sword of Washington, the other the staff of Franklin. One stood for the soldier who had fought the Revolutionary War. The staff of Franklin stood for the scholar. That staff I found very intriguing because when I first looked at it, it's about a 4-foot willow staff. It looks rather plain, except on the top of it, it has this gold, well, it's kind of a squiggly-do. It was given to Franklin by Madame Forbeck in France when he was our emissary from the U.S. to France. It was toward the end of the Revolutionary War. And she made this gift to him. And he really was taken by that gift. And as I did the research for it, I found out interesting things. He left that in a codicil in his will to George Washington. And he said, I leave my friend George Washington this staff. It could have been a scepter of a king, but instead it's crowned with a cap of liberty. Well, what the heck was Franklin saying and what did that mean? Well, when you look at the decorative gold on top of that staff, you realize that it's a fur cap. It's actually gold in the shape of a fur cap that Franklin wore to France when he was ambassador there. The French loved that cap. They took it as a mark of, you know, Americans being close to nature, of seeking liberty and freedom. And so this French lady decorates the cane with a fur cap. It stood in marked contrast to a French powdered wig.
What about Lincoln's silk hat, which you also have in your collection? And why was it typical of the clothing of the time?
Well, you know, it actually had been gaining in popularity from, you know, Aurora type of hats like a beaver fur and so on, fur caps. But Lincoln wore that hat, I think, to mark his stature. You know, Prince Albert in Britain was wearing top hats and made them fashionable. Lincoln was a kind of backwoods guy, and he ran on that reputation as president. But to fight the Civil War, he needed to show respectability. And so a top hat was really a mark more of an urban, sophisticated person. So he had a number of top hats that he wore, and this one was especially important because of, I'd say, two things. One, he decorated this hat with a black mourning band. That was in commemoration of his son, Willie, who had passed away during the Civil War, during the time he was in the White House. So Lincoln was mirroring on his hat his own mourning that mirrored the country, which was mourning for its lost sons in the war. The other reason that hat is particularly connected to history is that was the hat that Lincoln wore when he left the White House on April 14th, 1865. Rode a carriage over to Ford's Theater to see a play, Our American Cousin. Sat down in the box, took his hat off. People gave him a rousing ovation. He sat down, he put the hat next to him on the floor, right next to his chair. And of course, that was the night he was assassinated.
You have... Everything in this book is to me wonderful to behold. I mean, you have the Conestoga wagon, which people went west in the 1840s. You have the first gold flake discovered at Fort Sutter. You have the Colt revolver. Which or any one of those three would you like to talk about?
Well, let's talk about that gold flake, because what strikes me is you know, gold made California. It was the gold rush. That's what brought people to California, made it a state, made it part of our country. When you realize how small that gold flake was, this is the flake that James Marshall saw that morning in California in January. He just saw this glint of gold at Sutter's Mill. When you realize that that piece of gold is smaller in size than your pinky fingernail, and yet it was that piece of gold that occasioned such a big change in the United States. The gold was tested. It was brought back to Washington, given to President Polk, who ends up making a big deal of it as in his State of the Union address, because remember, when that gold was first discovered, California was still part of Mexico. The Mexican-American War had ended. The treaty had been signed. And California, literally, I think it was about 10 days later, became part of the United States. So this is a goal that made California. It kind of reminds us that seemingly small things and small discoveries could turn into very large innovations and have tremendous consequences. And, of course, that happens again about 150 years later with the development of another small thing from California, the microchip.
The juxtapositions and combinations are wonderful. I mean, the Colt revolver also had a great deal to do with American history. Where did that come about?
Yes, and that was, people at that time, if you look at the 1820s, 1830s, America was a pretty rough and tumble place. The West was, the frontier was close by to the East. Texans were making a lot of noise about their independence. American Indians still controlled a great deal of the country. And so, guns were part of winning the West and expanding the country at the time. A Colt, among a number of others, was looking at a way to basically invent a more efficient firearm. And one of the ideas was, of course, to have something that could be reloaded easy and have multiple fires instead of just thinking about a, you know, one-shot pistol where every time you wanted to fire something, you'd have to load it and fire it. He was inspired, apparently, by a ship. He took a journey on a ship, and he looked at the steering wheel of the ship, and he realized that here you were steering around a central axis. And he got the idea of kind of a revolving cartridge that would go around and hold bullets, and then when it clicked on the right space, it would go down a barrel. And so he develops the Patterson Colt. It becomes so important in Texas, in Texas's fight with Mexico, later with various battles with the Comanches and Indian tribes. And it becomes a firearm that really, at that time, helped settle and make the country.
You also have the lovely kind of juxtaposition, because you have the Declaration of Independence, but then you also have the Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter at which four African-American men sat down on February 1st, 1960. So it's independence revisited. Talk about the North Carolina lunch counter.
Yeah, this was February 1960, and, the South was segregated. The you had Jim Crow laws in that came in after Reconstruction in the South after the Civil War. African Americans in Greensboro, North Carolina, when they went into a Woolworths, they could take out food, but they couldn't sit down at the counter to eat. And lunch counters through the South, even in the North, became places in department stores where, you'd go shopping for various merchandise and essentials. And the idea was, well, if you had a counter there, you can sit down, lunch, you could gossip, you can do business and maybe stay a while and buy more things. These four men from North Carolina A&T just could not understand. Well, they did understand, but I think they wanted to do away with the whole notion of segregation and their inability to sit down at this counter. So they sat down at the counter. They came in late in the day. I think it was February 1st, 1960. And they sat down. They weren't served. They went home. The next day, they were joined by several other students. Over the course of a few days, they were joined by other men and women, blacks and whites. And the store became very raucous. You had people coming in with Confederate flags, taunting and spitting at the various students that would come in. Every time a white person would get up from the counter, a black person would sit down and not being served. And this really inspired many people. Now, this was inspiration for the civil rights movement. Remember, Rosa Parks had sat down in a bus. But this was something that was done by young people, and it spread through the South. By the summer, Dwight Eisenhower had said they should integrate. Woolworths did. Other department stores did. And those four students who began that sit down, they sat down in order to stand up for their freedom.
And you have the whole counter. It's not very big. I mean, how many seats at it do you have in the museum?
Yeah. Well, that counter in the original Woolworths, it had about 60 seats. And what happened is the Woolworths was going out of business, and the Smithsonian had been in touch with Woolworths about, when you go out of business, this is a historical artifact. I know you use it for lunch and you've used it that way for the last 30 years, but we would like to have it as part of our national patrimony at the Smithsonian. So we arranged with them, and we got an 8-foot section of the counter. Now, what was especially, and we took it up to Washington, and not only the counter, but the menus and the signage, so one gets a feel for that. What we do, if you go to the Smithsonian today and you go see that counter, we reenact that scene in February 1960, where visitors are asked to understand what it is to sit at that counter and not be served.
You also have wonderful cultural things. I mean, I'll give you three to choose from. You have Louis Armstrong's trumpet, known by the name of Satchmo, the trumpet. You also have Dorothy's ruby slippers worn by Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz, and Woody Guthrie's recording of This Land Is Your Land.
Yeah, those are great, and they've come to really stand in many ways for American culture. The Louis Armstrong's trumpet days come out of his background in New Orleans, then Chicago and New York. He became a worldwide ambassador for jazz, which became an American landmark cultural contribution, totally unique to America. And yet now it's spread around the world. People in Eastern Europe and Australia and Asia play jazz and appreciate jazz. It's wonderful. But I kind of like the others too. Dorothy's ruby slippers, just a quick anecdote about those. In the original Frank Baum story about the Wizard of Oz, they were to be silver. And it was a whole play, many people think, about the silver and gold standard, the currency standard in the United States, kind of a parody. What happened was, with the invention of Technicolor in the late 1930s, the people working on the film looked at what those gray or silver slippers would look like on the screen, and they were pretty dull. And so somebody came up with the idea of making them a ruby red. And with the new magic of the Technicolor technology, those red slippers, they danced their way into, I think, American iconography.
The large objects you have, I mean, Lindbergh's plane, you have the Enola Gay, the plane from which the first atomic bomb was dropped on Japan in 1945. You also have the flyer flown by Wilbur and Orville Wright in Kitty Hawk in 1903. It's such a marvelous collection you put together. Richard, is there anything that you really were sorry to have left out?
Well,
I mean, I'm sure there were many things, but is there anything in particular that you think has gone missing?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because the Smithsonian has so much. But there's great things distributed through museums around the country, certainly in Washington, the National Archives. You have the original, not quite the original, actually, a Declaration of Independence. At the Smithsonian, we have the copy that was made in 1823, because the original one was fading. So I try to tell the story of some of the things the Smithsonian doesn't have by referencing other museums, libraries, and archives that do have those things. The Golden Spike for the railroad, for example, that joined East and West, the Transcontinental Railroad, that's over in the Stanford University Museum. So, there are things in other places that one would always get. But I think the good thing about America and the country is that, the Smithsonian doesn't agglomerate it all. It doesn't have to have it all. And we love the fact that really the treasures of the American experience are distributed around the country.
Among the ones that I like best looking at in your book was the Morse Vale telegraph key. I mean, I've been in the communications business and for all my life, and here's something from 1844, and that's the beginning.
Yeah, that's the one that sent electrical impulses down the line, and it's that one is so interesting, because not only about its basic invention, but how technology changes so quickly, and also how it uses and changes society. So the original telegraph developed by Morse was really more like a fax machine. That is, when you do those dots and dashes over the line, they actually had a register to print out a paper message, and then you would decode that. Well, what happened very quickly is the telegraph guys who were doing the telegraph, they could just hear the dots and dashes from the clicking of the technology. They didn't need a piece of paper to show them the dots and dashes. So that part of the invention disappeared. The other thing, and the other story I tell in the book, is that how the telegraph is used by, well, former head of the Smithsonian, Joseph Henry, he was very much into weather. And in the late 1840s, following the development of the telegraph, he was able to send thermometers and barometers to people around the United States. He called them correspondents. Today they would be weather buddies. And what they did is they recorded the temperature every day in different towns and cities in the country. They telegraphed, using the telegraph now. They had a new technology. They telegraphed him in Washington. He was able to record their measurements on a map. And that was the origins of the National Weather Map and the National Weather Service. So the technology actually allowed then farmers and others to basically predict and understand weather patterns that was so useful in the age. So what begins in a certain way as an invention changed very, very quickly. And I think we see that today with new technologies.
Well, I think you see that throughout your book. I mean, how things – I mean, we like to think that we're living in an era of extraordinarily rapid change, but it seems we've been doing so for the last 200-odd years.
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing about American history. You know, when you think of places that have long-lived civilizations, I've done a lot of work in India and Asia. And when you think of, you know, how old is Chinese civilization and Indian civilization, the civilizations in the Middle East, these go back a long, long way. America's a very young country, but it's lived very quickly. And it's lived very fully, so much so. In the book, the first object and the last object kind of bookend American history. And I felt we needed to put American history in some type of larger context. So the first object in the book is 500 million years old. It's fossils. At the founding of North America, there wasn't human life. What did life look like? What was the climate like? So that's the first object in the book. And the last, the 101st, is what we call the Giant Magellan Telescope. This is an object that doesn't exist yet. This is what the Smithsonian, along with other universities and governments, are building. It will be the largest telescope on the planet. And that will enable us to see back close to the Big Bang. So what you have is American history bookended by the past going back 500 million years and the future peering out to the universe. It puts it in perspective. Our history is but a blink of an eye in this universe.
Thank you, Richard Curran, for speaking with us today about the history of America in 101 Objects. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2013.